With a larger room, I have to project more here. I want to thank again Laser and Albert for setting this up. And this morning our topic is, as you see on your sheets, the double effect and virapo yirape. And the discussion on this topic will affect specific cases, as well as our overall approach to the practice of medicine. And it's particularly important, actually, in terms of the psychology of the physician and what he encounters in dealing with a patient's needs. I learned a lot in this class. Usually when I prepare these, I learn a lot in terms of technical jargon. So for a lot of the cases that we've handled in the past, over the last, 15 months or so, I've learned about all sorts of medical conditions and treatments and the like. This one doesn't involve as much in the way of technical jargon, anatomy, that sort of thing. But nonetheless, I learned an awful lot in preparing this, and I hope to convey it here. So first of all, double effect is a description of a phenomenon. It's a description of, to put it loosely and not entirely completely, an action which leads to both a positive and negative result for the patient. That's very loose. We're going to refine that more, but that's a good definition for us to begin with, and we'll give several cases to illustrate that. If you look on your first page, on your outline, you see the table. So I listed six possible actions, six cases of physician intervention. What the goal is, what are we trying to prevent, what are we trying to heal? What it might end up causing along the way, and the question of whether the potential harm involved is caused directly or indirectly, and we'll see why that matters. I stress right at the outset that for two of them, I put under the cause for our purposes, and you'll see what I mean when I get there, but I want to make sure to call attention to it. So our first case, our first two cases, are cases in which the physician is trying to prevent the death of the patient and is going to engage in a treatment which is going to cause some level of suffering for the patient, a level which is not equal to death, and is going to cause it either directly or indirectly. The first is the case of a hypothetical vaccination which causes a strong reaction. Hypothetical because I didn't want to get into the specifics of particular vaccines. I started reading the literature on it, and there's just so much debate, and there's so much information which one side will say is misinformation and the other one will say is accurate, that I chose not to select a particular vaccine. But a vaccine which is known to cause in many patients a high fever, to cause severe discomfort, and the result of that, the pain or the illness that it may cause, is an indirect result. It's not that in order to prevent the patient's death, I am going to cause a high fever. The fever is not what I do in order to heal the patient or to prevent illness for the patient. It's a side effect. It's something that happens along the way. As opposed to the second case. The second case, the patient with a gangrenous limb, where amputation is indicated. So I'm trying to prevent death of the patient from the spread of the gangrene. The reality is that I'm going to cause the patient pain. I'm going to cause the patient disfigurement directly. The difference between the first case and the second case is that in the first case, it's a side effect. The negatives are a side effect. In the second case, it's actually direct. I need to do that. I need to disfigure the patient in order to heal the patient. Do you see the difference between the two? Okay, direct and indirect is going to matter. The second set of cases, there in the table, are cases in which I'm trying to prevent pain rather than death. Whereas what I'm going to cause, potentially, is death. The first of the two cases that I mentioned is palliative end-of-life care, and I stress in there that it's potentially causing death for our purposes. The case is probably familiar to the physicians here, but I'll spell it out. The patient is in an end-of-life situation. There's nothing that I can do medically that's going to save the patient's life. There's nothing I can even do that's going to extend the patient's life, really. The patient is in extreme pain, and I'd like to administer administer morphine. And the concern is that administering the morphine might depress the patient's breathing to the point where the patient is actually going to die sooner. The reason I say that's for our purposes is because studies have shown over the last 10, 15 years that if administered responsibly, the morphine is not going to depress the patient's breathing to that point. Number one, because you can carefully ration what you're giving the patient, and number two, because patients who reach that point generally have built up a sensitivity to morphine from previous treatments. So I'm not giving this the full treatment of it. I'm sure that the physicians who are in palliative care can give it a more full treatment. The point that I'm bringing, though, is that I only mention this case as a for our purposes case, because the truth of the matter is that you can administer the morphine without triggering the patient's death. Nonetheless, this is a standard case to mention in terms of double effect. Here I have a patient whose pain I want to alleviate, but in the course of alleviating it, I could cause death indirectly. And it's indirect because it's not that I want to cause the patient's death in order to treat the pain. It's that that's a side effect. I'm not trying to depress the patient. It isn't that depressing the patient's breathing is what's treating the pain. It's just a side effect along the way. As opposed to the second case, the anti-gasping paralytics. I have a patient who is experiencing pain because they are gasping for breath. I have the option of administering a neuromuscular blocking agent, something that's going to keep the patient from being able to gasp. So I say, well, I'm alleviating the patient's pain. Well, it also happens that I'm going to cause the patient to suffocate that way, right? Gasping is something the patient does in order to get more air. So am I able to do that when, in fact, what I'm doing is directly causing the patient's death, far more directly, because the action I'm trying to induce is the action that will cause the patient to die. Are we clear on the second set of cases? Okay. The last two cases are special cases. It's not going to be clear right now why they're here. It'll be clear by the end, God willing. The first of them is giving the patient a treatment, and we're dealing with a male specifically here, that will render the patient impotent. And this is, I need to spell this out a little bit more. There are certain medications, the case I gave there is an antidepressant called Paxil, which could render a male patient, not all patients, I think for Paxil the highest number I've seen is 10%, but it could render the male patient unable to bear children for the period at least that he's taking the medication. This may not be prohibited under the law against serous. There is a mitzvah that says that I'm not allowed to render a male unable to have children. However, it's not clear that will apply to such a medication. That's beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about today in terms of what is included in the prohibition called serus in Hebrew. I'm not going there. The only reason I bring this is because it's a good illustration of a case, hypothetically, in which I administer a medication in order to save a patient from pain or worse. I'm giving the patient an antidepressant because I'm concerned about the patient's not only mental health, but also, in addition to that, the patient's physical health. But on the other hand, I could cause, via administration of this medication, I could cause an avera. Assuming that this, you know, rendering the patient impotent in this way would actually be violation of a prohibition. It's not necessarily, I want to stress that because I don't want people coming away saying that Torchiner said giving a male an antidepressant could be a violation of serus. Don't go there. I'm using it as an illustration, and again, it'll be more clear when we get to it later.
In this case, on your chart, under the heading and called causing,
yes,
the sin is on the doctor at this point.
The sin is potentially on the doctor, correct. The last case is an ectopic abortion using methotrexate. And I stress the method there for reasons that we'll get to. In ectopic abortion, the fetus begins to develop outside of the fallopian tube. As I understand it, either it's going to be resorbed by the body, or, you know, on its own somehow the pregnancy won't develop, or God forbid it does develop and it causes pain and potentially death for the mother. The fetus doesn't survive either way. You can't carry a fetus to term this way. Is that's consistent with the knowledge of the physicians here? Okay. So they have a treatment called methotrexate, which at least for the last 15, 16 years has been used to terminate such a pregnancy early so that the embryo does not develop. I am preventing the death of the mother. I'm causing the death of the fetus, remember that it's a fetus, is considered to be part of the mother at this stage of development, and I'm doing it directly. These six cases all illustrate different ways in which a physician could treat a patient in a way that will save the patient from harm, but also cause some degree of harm. And the question is, am I allowed to engage in the positive activity, knowing that I'm also going to cause the negative activity? I'm going to cause the negative effect, I should say. I'm causing a positive effect as well as a negative effect. This is what is classically called double effect. Everyone good so far? Okay. Double effect is often addressed with what's called double effect reasoning, or the doctrine of the double effect, or the principle of the double effect. I read through something like 15 papers on double effect, and I saw all sorts of different terms for this. It's a philosophical approach, which I never knew until I prepared for this year. I've spoken about double effect before, but until I started preparing for this year, I never knew it's actually a Christian philosophical approach. People here knew that? Yeah, I didn't know that. That was news to me. I thought it was just a general philosophical approach to situations, and I had no idea that that it actually emerged from the church. It developed specifically It's not in the Gemara. No, I'll get to why, and you'll see. It's developed by Thomas Aquinas, actually, in his Summa Theologica. And he's dealing with double effect situations. That was chiddush number one for me, was the fact that this actually is from the church. Chiddush number two for me is that when you really think it through, you realize just how disturbing double effect should be for a physician. Double effect is extremely problematic. It happens to also be against halacha, but that will get to. But it's really a very troubling, disturbing idea. The context in which it's developed is the discussion of homicidal self-defense. Someone comes to attack me, and I want to save my life. Am I allowed to save my life by killing my assailant? So we're familiar with the pasuk in the Torah. It's there in source Aleph. Guy breaks into my house. I suspect that he would kill me. I am allowed to kill him first. And ein lo damim, we treat him as though he is dead already. There is no compensation necessary. He has suspended his life by invading my home. So that pasuk becomes very important because Augustine, writing in the 4th century, says, it's source number 1, I do not agree with the opinion that one may kill a man lest one be killed by him, unless one be a soldier or exercise a public office, that one does it not for oneself but for others. So Augustine, this church father, says you can't kill somebody in order to save yourself. And the problem with that is, well, what does he do with the pasuk? Now, the answer may be what they did with many psukim, but he doesn't want to do that. He doesn't want to cancel out a pasuk in Parashas Mishpatim. And so, Thomas Aquinas works with this and other church sources, and he comes up with the following suggestion, source number 2. He says, nothing hinders one act from having two effects, only one of which is intended, while the other is beside the intention, right? Double effect. You have two results, one of which is what you wanted to do, and the other of which is not what you wanted to do. Accordingly, the act of self-defense may have two effects. One, the saving of one's life. The other, the slaying of the aggressor. Though proceeding from a good intention, an act may be rendered unlawful if it be out of proportion to the end. He adds one more point. Number one, he's concerned about your intent. And number two, that the good be greater than the bad. What I'm trying to accomplish that is good has to be greater than the negative I'm trying to avoid. And that builds the philosophy of the double effect. In short, if my intent is to accomplish the good, and the good is of greater magnitude than the bad that I'm avoiding, then my action is justified. Right? People are familiar in general with double effect. I think that's consistent with what you've heard. Right? So far, so good. Laser? Yeah?
That's just a fundamental question.
Yeah.
This double effect, I mean, is it anything more than a side effect? I'm just having trouble understanding the concept.
Right. So am I. It includes side effects, but theoretically it can also include direct results. In the cases that I gave in the initial table, that's why I specified direct versus indirect. So an indirect case would be where I'm giving the patient the painkiller and it depresses the patient's breathing. It's a side effect. It is a direct cause. I mean, it's caused by what I'm doing, but it's not what I was trying to accomplish. And if I had my druthers, I would rather alleviate the patient's pain without depressing his breathing. As opposed to the case of cutting off the gangrenous limb, where I am trying to cut off a limb. It's not a side effect. I'm cutting off a patient's limb. So that's the distinction that I would draw. And theoretically, both would be under double effect. Now, to take that a step further, apply the reasoning of double effect now. Would I be allowed to give this painkiller, assuming it really did depress the patient's breathing? Would I be allowed to?
Not according to that philosophy you just said.
Why not? Right.
That's worse.
Right. So the argument, the double effect argument, is that this patient is dying anyway. There's nothing I can do. He's in great pain, and that actually for him to die at this point is less bad than for him to live in excruciating pain that we can't alleviate for a few seconds longer. Which, by the way, is also found within Gemara. I mean, that's not new to us. The Gemara in Nedarim actually sanctions the idea of davening for somebody's death because they're in great pain. So it's beyond the scope of what we're going to do today, but know that that's not alien to us. But on the other hand, would double effect permit me, so double effect would permit me under this, to give this kind of painkiller before when the patient is in this situation, even knowing it'll depress the patient's breathing. We're going to come back to this a little bit. We have to see Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach on it, but we'll see. On the other hand, would double effect permit me to amputate the patient's limb in the case of gangrene? No, I'm asking strict double effect.
Yes,
it would. Why?
Because the outcome overwhelms the consequences of the action.
Yeah, but what about intent? I intend. This is a direct. This is not a side effect. This is direct result of what I'm doing. If you look again at source number two. But I intend both. But Aquinas in his formulation is not okay with the idea that I can intend the harm. He wants my. So this is a very good question. How do we read him? Now, keep in mind this is a class about halacha rather than the Aquinas' philosophy. But I will take it a couple of steps further because it's a good question. It's an important one in order to understand the differences between that approach and the approach within halacha. I did a lot of reading.
What's the
Rashi? Right, there are a lot of papers. I can give you a whole long list. There's a lot of literature on this question of how I define intent. In this case, in the case of the gangrenous limb, what exactly is my intent? Do you say that because my direct intent is to cut off a limb, that means I intend for him to have to lose his limb? But I could always say that. In the case then of killing somebody to save my life, my intent is to save my life. But he won't allow me to kill the other guy in order to do it. It seems to be a problem, because my intent is only to save my life. My intent is only for the good. So some suggest that if the harmful act is what causes the benefit, it is automatically considered intentional. And that's actually hardcore within the school of double effect. This is actually one of the basic principles that they say. If the harmful act or the harmful effect is what causes the benefit, is the means to the end, then it's automatically considered intentional. They will not allow me to amputate the limb. They end up permitting the amputation of the limb for different reasons beyond the scope of double effect. We'll see. We'll get to it. But the under basic double effect, I'm not allowed to amputate the limb. They won't let it. You'll see. We're going to come back to it at the end, what they do with it, because that's an interesting thing in and of itself. But the rule is that if the harm is the means to the end, I can't do it. I'll give you an illustration. The classic illustration of this is the case of the trolley car. They give you two different cases. This is not a medical case, but it's a general case. Case number one. There's a train running down the tracks. It's going to hit five people. I have the option of flipping a switch, and then it'll go onto a sidetrack. If it goes onto the sidetrack, it's going to hit one person, but it'll miss the five. I'm allowed to do that. The reason I'm allowed to do that is because hitting the one is a side effect. It's not the means towards the end. The means is flipping the switch. So they say that's okay. But then they ask another question. They, the philosophers of double effect, the people who propose this as an ideal. Yeah. No, because it's not a halachic statement. It's a, so, right, and that's where I want to go with it. On the other hand, let's say the train is going down the track, it's going to hit the five people, but if I push somebody in the way, then hitting that person will slow down the train enough that the train won't hit the five. Am I allowed to do that? And they say, no. Because there, hitting this person is the means of accomplishing the good. And automatically, that means hitting the person is the intent. That's the idea. That's what the philosophy of double effect says. They go through other approaches to try to distinguish intent. They talk about distinguishing between what I intend and what I foresee happening. That's one distinction that they draw. It could be that you... I want to see if I put it on here. No, I didn't. Okay. They talk about the fact that I can tell something is going to happen as a result of my action, but that doesn't mean that's what I want to have happen. Another distinction that they draw is between doing X because Y will result and doing X in order for Y to result. They talk about throwing a party. And I want to throw a party, but I don't want to because I have to clean up afterwards. But I know that if I invite a lot of people to my party, then they'll feel grateful that I made a party and they'll help me clean up afterwards. So therefore, I'm okay with it. I'm okay with having the party. So is that intent? Do I invite people so that they will help clean up? Do I hold a party so that they will help me clean up? No. But I'm holding the party only because they're going to do it. Because they're going to help me. Is that called intent or not? They go through discussions about thick intent versus thin intent. This is my favorite case, and then we'll get into what Halacha actually has to say. I happen to enjoy this case because it's very similar to a Gemara. There are explorers in a cave. You've heard this case? Anyone here ever do reading on double effect? Okay, this case comes up a lot. The title they use for it is politically incorrect, and I apologize in advance, but they call it the Fat Man case. The case is that there are explorers in a cave, and the last guy coming in is extremely large, and he ends up blocking the entrance, and he's stuck. And the explorers can't get out. They run out of supplies. How are they supposed to get out of the cave? Well, they have some dynamite. They can blow him up, and that'll get them out of the cave. And so the question is, are they allowed to blow him up in order to get out of the cave? And they argue that my intent is not to blow him up. My intent is not to kill him. My intent is to remove him from the entrance. That's their argument. Much like the gangrenous limb case. Right? I don't want to disfigure the person. I just want to stop the gangrene from spreading. So that's the argument, is that I'd like to be able to do it. I don't really want him dead. I just want to blow him up. Which reminds everybody of the case in the Gemara of Sigreshe, right? My child wants to play with a chicken, with the head of a chicken. It's Shabbos, right? What am I supposed to do? I would like to cut off the head of the chicken. I'm not trying to kill the chicken. It's just a side effect of cutting off its head, generally speaking. So the Gemara says, well, Sigreshe, Velo Yamos, can you cut off its head without it dying? Right? That's the case that reminded me of in the Gemara. Can I blow this guy up without him actually dying? They go further with that because they ask, what if you could use less dynamite and it would blow him up and it wouldn't kill him, but then he'd be suffering? It's a whole arichas svara. Right, they argue about Monichle. Also, we're going to come back to that because that's going to be important later. The bottom line out of all of this is a very disturbing message to me. Because the message of double effect philosophy is that if the benefit exceeds the cost, and the goal is only for the benefit, then I may engage in double effect activity. It's not just a cost-benefit analysis. It requires, number one, that the cost be greater than the benefit. I'm sorry, the benefit be greater than the cost. And number two, that my goal only be for the benefit. So double effect does two things which are very important to realize. Number one, it permits inevitable harm if that harm is not my intent. And number two, it prohibits harm if that harm is my intent. And in neither of those cases is it going to agree with halacha. Let's get into halacha. In non-medicine, forget medicine for a second, we'll deal with general activity. We accept the emphasis on intent. We don't allow, though, inevitable damage. Right? This brings us to Hilchos Shabbos, the laws of Shabbos. If you take a look at source base, Gemara in Shabbos, Rabbi Shimon Omer, it's a Braisa, Rabbi Shimon, it says, Gorer Adam Kise Mita Vesasol, Ubavash La Yiskabe Lasos Charitz. Rabbi Shimon says, I am allowed to drag a chair on Shabbos. I am allowed to drag a bed, a bench, even though it will create a groove in the ground, and you're not allowed to create a groove in the ground on Shabbos. I can drag these things. Why? If, or under what condition? As long as I don't intend to make the groove in the ground. That's called davar she'eino miskaven, an action that I did not intend. And the rule is, it's permitted on Shabbos per Rabbi Shimon, and we follow Rabbi Shimon. However, there is a limitation. The limitation is what we call psik reshe. That's psik reshe below yomus, where it's a guaranteed result of my action. And that's source gimel. Tanu Rabbanan, the Braisa says, Hatzad chilazon v'hapotz'o eino chayev ela achas. Chilazon, right, the sea creature from which you get to chelez dye. So you had to kill the sea creature and extract the dye. If I trap a chilazon on Shabbos, and I am potzea it, I crush it, to remove this dye material, eino chayev ela achas. I'm only liable once, which presumably means I'm liable for trapping and not for crushing it. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Chayev Shtayim. Rabbi Yehuda says, no, I'm liable twice. Shai Rabbi Yehuda Omer Petzia Bechlal Disha, because Rabbi Yehuda says that crushing it in order to remove this material is actually called Disha. It's like threshing in the sense that you're taking a hole and you're breaking it down into sub parts, just like threshing grain. You take a whole piece of grain and then you smash it into small pieces. Amru lo, they replied to Rabbi Yehuda, Eim Petzia Bechlal Disha. These are two different things. End of quote from the Braisa. Amar Rava, Rava says, "My time of the Rabbanan." What's the Rabbanan's rationale? The Rabbanan's rationale for permitting this pitzia, for permitting crushing it, is because Kesavri ain't disha elul gidulei karka. They said the prohibition against threshing on Shabbos is only about things that grow from the ground. If it doesn't grow from the ground, then it's not called threshing when I crush it. Okay, so I have a piece of meat, and I want to crush it into its pieces. I'm okay. That's not called threshing. There may be other issues. The tochin, whatever, that's not the point. The Gemara's next question is the point. V'lachayiv nami mishum netilas neshama. Why am I not liable for killing the chilazon? I took the sea creature and I crushed it. I killed it. You're not allowed to kill things on Shabbos. So why am I not liable for that? Amar Rabbi Yochanan shepitzao meis. Rabbi Yochanan says, because it's talking about where it was already dead. Trapping it must have been easy. He says it's where it was already dead. I wasn't the one who caused its death. Somebody else caused its death, and now I'm crushing it when it's already dead, so therefore I'm not liable for killing it. Rava Amar Afilu Tema Shepetzao Chai. Rava says, even if you did it while it was alive, that's okay. Misasek Hu Eitzel Tilas Neshama. This is what I call misasek. I am involved in a separate activity which happens to cause the death of the chilazon. But I'm not trying to do that. I'm just extracting dye. So therefore, even though the result is inevitable, I'm okay, according to the Rabbanan. To which they ask, Abaye v'Rava Damri Travayu Moda Rabbi Shimon b'psik Reisha v'lo Yamus, but don't Abaye and Rava both say that even if you permit non-intended results, if they're inevitable, psik Reisha, then they're not permitted? To which he answers, well, Sha'ani Hacha, it's different over here. It's different here because you want the chilazon to survive. Because as long as the chilazon survives, you're going to have better chances of getting good dye from the chilazon. Some kind of lysis sets in or something. When the chilazon is dead, it breaks down the material that you'd use to get the dye. So you actually want to preserve the life of the chilazon. So what emerges from these two gemaras, source Aleph and source Beis, are three principles. Number one, within halacha, if I don't intend the result, it's permitted, unless it's a guaranteed result. If it's a guaranteed result, and it's not a negative result from my perspective, then my intention is irrelevant. So to put that in maybe a little more in a more clear format, I am allowed to engage in activities on Shabbos which have a guaranteed negative result. Okay, if they would cause violation of Shabbos, but the resulting violation would be a negative to me, even though it's inevitable, I'm allowed to engage in the activity. If the result is not negative, it's neutral or positive, then if it's a guaranteed result, I can't engage in it. Let's say that killing the chilazon would actually be better for my removal of the dye, or wouldn't affect my removal of the dye at all. Then I couldn't crush it on Shabbos, because I am killing it, and killing it is prohibited on Shabbos. Even though I don't want to kill it particularly, nonetheless, it's prohibited. Is everyone clear on that piece of things? Yeah.
The intent is either positive or neutral,
mm-hmm.
and that would be allowed.
No, that would be not allowed. I'm sorry. If I say to the opposite, then I'm okay. If the result is positive or neutral, then I am not allowed to do it because it's inevitable. That's what I should have said. Okay. This has an interesting application. Well, first take a look at Source Dalet, where the Rambam informs us that this extends beyond the laws of Shabbos. This is not unique to the laws of Shabbos, even though Shabbos has certain rules, Melechus Machshavas, that are beyond the scope of the discussion this morning. But the Rambam tells you about people who are dealing with Shatnez clothing. I'm not allowed to wear Shatnez. So he says, Tofer Iksus, Tofer Kedargon, people who sew clothing and they're sewing Shatnez can do so normally. And that means that they can even wear the clothing on themselves as they are sewing it. As long as they don't intend to shelter themselves from the sun or from the rain, wearing this clothing, as long as it's not their intent, right, they're okay. He's employing the same principle, right? It's an inevitable result, right, that you're going to be It's not an inevitable result. If it's a davar she'einu miskaven, if it's what I don't intend, if I don't intend to benefit from it, then I'm okay. It's not dealing with an inevitable result. Why it's not an inevitable result, I should have prepared more material on that for why it's not an inevitable result. I realize that looking at it, it looks like it's inevitable. I'm going to have to stipulate right now that it's talking about a non-inevitable case and leave it at that. The Rambam statement is that because this is not my intent, because I don't intend to profit from the wearing of the garment, it's considered to be permitted. Okay. This has an interesting application in source Hay regarding somebody who wants to play a dangerous game for a living. He wants to play some kind of a game where it involves a ball, that we see in the tshuva, and people apparently endanger themselves. I don't know what game this is. I don't know if this is a highlight or I don't know exactly what. But source Hay, Nish'alti me'echad, I was asked by someone, Im muter lehisparnes mi mischag zrikas hakadurim, shenikra ball bilaz. Am I allowed to profit from the game of throwing a ball? See, actually, I wonder. His wording is lehisparnes. He may mean for me to make money off it, not that I'm the player. I may not be the athlete. I may be just somebody who's betting on the game or owns a team. Betting being its own discussion. Sheish lachush lesakana. He says there's potential danger. As happens to one in thousands that he actually gets endangered. Veishavti, I answered, Shalafi ani yizdaiti, in my humble opinion, yesh lahatir. You could permit this. Why? There's a Gemara in Bava Metzia, he says. The Gemara in Bava Metzia talks about somebody who climbs a tree for the sake of his work. and he gets harmed. And the Gemara doesn't say he's not allowed to climb the tree for the sake of his work. You see from the Gemara that you are allowed to engage in some kind of work which is dangerous work. Why? It's for the sake of making a living, and ultimately your intent is not to to harm yourself. This has applications as well for the issue of mitzvah ba'avera. Right? If I steal a lulav in order to perform the mitzvah of lulav on Sukkos, is that okay? Not okay. It's the source in Gemara it's the Gemara in source Vav. I'm not allowed to fulfill lulav by stealing a lulav. Why not? It's not my intent. I don't intend to steal from him. But it's an inevitable result. Sorry? No, I don't. I just want to pick up a lulav. It happens to be that now he won't have his lulav anymore. But it's not what I want. I don't want to steal from him any more than I want to cut off the guy's limb, any more than I want to depress the patient's breathing. It's a side effect. The end result of my action is that he no longer has a lulav. We do say that you're not allowed to do this. There are more discussions also beyond medicine, but I want to apply this to medicine rather than remain in the non-medicine context. Sorry? Okay, when it comes to medicine, we do know that we are permitted to engage in medical treatments that cause harm. Take a look at Source Zion, please, a quote which we actually have used before from Yaakov Emden in his Morag Tzia. He says, some people choose to endanger their lives in medical treatment in order to save themselves from great suffering. Such as people who give themselves for surgery because they have a kidney stone. He gives the example of some kind of a stone that the patient wants to have, I think that's what he's talking about, that a patient wants to have removed, and he'll undergo surgery endangering his life, right? Because remember that he's writing this in the 18th century. The surgery certainly was far more dangerous than what we would talk about today. So he says, people do that. And he says, we permit this. We do not protest. Because many times it works. They're saved and they are healed. So he's willing to permit me to engage in a dangerous activity in order to save myself from pain. Medical treatments that can cause harm, it can even cause death. And even if it doesn't cause death, you're cutting into me. That's what we call chavala. That's called wounding. He's willing to permit it. So an action which has harm, potential grievous harm, is permitted for the sake of the benefit. And so the question is, what is the halachic rationale? So one approach, and this is written up in an article by Rabbi Richard I. Weiss, Rabbi Dr. Richard I. Weiss, is that it is in fact a function of davar she'eino miskaven. His idea is that if I don't intend the harm, I am allowed to engage in the activity, sort of like double effect, except with recognition that psik reisha is going to limit us. If the harm is inevitable, then it's not permitted. That's his argument. I can support his position via source ches. The Rosh on the Gemara in Shabbos. B'she'iltos d'Rav Achai Kasuv. He quotes the text She'iltos d'Rav Achai Gaon. It's from the time of the Gaonim. It's a halachic text, although it's organized by the Parsha, which throws people off. But it's halacha. He says, Aser lishtos sama demali lagufa umeyakar. Rav Achai Gaon ruled that one is not allowed to drink a potion to heal him from something if it will also cause him to be unable to reproduce. So argues Rav Achai Gaon. And he explains, Mishum dechsivu ba'artzechem lo sa'asu, kari be lo se'asu, because the Torah says, you shall not do this in your land, meaning you shall not have this done to you either. So in terms of the question of whether serus is a prohibition for the doctor, he says it's a prohibition for the patient as well to undergo this activity which will render him unable to reproduce. And he says, "V'davka l'Rabbi Yehuda huda aser di'islay davar she'enu miskaven aser." He says that's unique to Rabbi Yehuda, because Rabbi Yehuda prohibits actions which cause inevitable harm. Aval Rabbi Shimon mutter, but Rabbi Shimon will permit it. Kevin Shein miskaving l'sirus ela l'refuah, because your intent really is to heal. So he employs this principle of davar she'eno miskaving, and the Rush has a nice discussion on this as well. And what he ends up saying is that we say medical treatment that will help, but also cause violation of an yisur, is prohibited under psik reishe. So one approach is that my intent, it will be that if it's unintended, if the negative result is unintended, but it's inevitable, then the action is prohibited. That's what he's saying. In the case in which the patient takes the medicine, right? The medicine is going to heal him from whatever other unspecified ailment he has. However, it also has the effect of rendering him impotent.
For sure,
in this case. Not the Paxil case that I gave at the outset. It's talking about inevitably. The stats I looked at on chemotherapy, unless you talk about something harsher, we didn't have that kind of 100% certainty. Right, so they discussed that also. They discussed the case as well. The reason I didn't use that as my example, well, he didn't, I mean, the Russian, because that wasn't what he was dealing with. I didn't use it because then you're talking also about pikuach nefesh cases, saving a life, and I wanted to stay away from that because that's going to be a class unto itself. Sorry? No. Not necessarily. It's talking about something that's good for the body to heal some lesser condition. It's not necessarily talking about life-saving conditions, life-saving situations. So the statement here that the Rush is making is that I can't take this medicine that's going to heal me from a non-life-threatening situation if it's also going to cause impotence. Because it's inevitable, even though it's not what I intended. So this is double effect with a very serious limitation. He has disarmed or defanged double effect. Because the major strength of double effect, and the reason why people like it, is because it permits an inevitable result. And he's saying, no, it doesn't. No, he's saying double effect can do what it wants. Halacha doesn't. That's the Rush's argument. And that's what Richard Weiss, I think, contends as well. However, I don't think this is correct. And the reason I disagree is because of source Yud. Source Tess is the same source, but it's from the Me'iri. And I wanted to bring you the one from the Shulchan Aruch. I brought the Me'iri also so you could see it, if you get a chance to look at it later. But take a look at source Yud. Talking about doing surgery, which is going to cause a wound, and doing surgery on a parent in particular, where there's an extra prohibition against wounding a parent. Haya, and this is not a life-saving case. Haya kodes tachuv le'aviv. If a person's father has a thorn in his skin, lo yotzianu, the kid cannot remove it. Shema yavo lasos bo chabura, because he may wound his father by doing so. V'cheinim humakiz dam, and so too if the kid is a bloodletter by trade. O rofe, or a physician. Lo yakiz dam le'aviv, he may not let blood for his father. V'lo yachtoch lo eiver, he may not cut off a limb. Afo pishem achavin l'refuah, even though his intent is medicinal. Nonetheless, the Shulchan Aruch writes, the Mechaber writes, you can't. Comes the Ramah and says, not so fast. Hagah. The Ramah says, Bamed devar amamurim, when is this true? B'sheyesham acher lazos. If there is somebody else who could do it, then the guy's own kid shouldn't be the one to do it. Because you have other options. Avalam einsham acher lasos. But if there's no one else who can do it, v'hu mitzta'er, and the father is in pain, harehu makiza v'chotech lo k'fima sheyershuhu lasos, the kid should do whatever the father permits him to do, up to and including letting blood and amputating a limb. That's an inevitable result. Right? If you cut off his limb, it's inevitable you're going to cause him a wound. How could you permit this if our philosophy is that davar she'eino miskaven is only permitted if it's inevitable? If we're limited by psik reisha, you follow? If the principle that we employ regarding normal activity, I think I have a good way to phrase this. Regarding normal activity, we say, forget medicine for a second, we say if it's going to have a negative effect that's inevitable, then the action is prohibited. If you're going to apply that to medicine, then the kid should not be allowed to amputate the father's limb in a non-life-threatening situation. But the Ramah explicitly permits it. Does the Ramah not know the principle of psik reisha? You follow the problem? So I have to get in touch with Richard Weiss, because I actually have his email address. I have to find out what he'll say to this. Maybe he has a response, and if he does, I will let the group know.
The Ramah,
his email hasn't been working in a while. Someone else has his address now. Yeah, Blazer.
I thought you would just do the exact opposite, because if you look at the Mahavir clearly said that you don't look at the intention, and the Ramah's exception is only falls under some sort of equivalent method, which is exceptional.
He's explicitly not.
But the Ramah himself would say that outside of any of his special circumstances, he would agree with the Mahavir.
Right, so the Ramah specifically is not dealing with a life-threatening case. He stresses, v'hu mitzta'er. If you look at the Me'iri, the Ramah would not have seen the Me'iri, but in source number test, the Me'iri at that point was no longer around in manuscript. It wasn't rediscovered for centuries after the Ramah, but the idea was current among the sources in general. The end of the Me'iri, he says, im ein sham acher behem mistaknim o mitzta'arim, if they are in danger or they are in pain. We distinguish between the two cases, and he's willing to permit it, even if it's just avoiding pain. The Ramah didn't even mention the Sakana case. He only mentioned the Mitzara case. It's a thorn in the guy's skin. Not the case of amputation, but the case of the thorn. He's willing to permit it, even though it's going to cause a bruise. It's going to cause some kind of wound when I remove it. You could argue that's not a guaranteed case. You might be able to present that. But the amputation. But the amputation is.
The case that the Gemara bases on is that it may not cause a wound.
Mm-hmm. But the Ramah is dealing with amputation also. That's beyond the Gemara's case. So I have a problem with this. So Rabbi J. David Bleich offers a solution, which is my second approach, but it doesn't really deal with all cases. Rabbi Bleich's point is that pain itself is considered to be a threat to life often in the sources. And therefore, you could consider avoiding pain like pikuach nefesh. If you take a look, for example, at I'm going to use the shorter quote. Ramosha has a long discussion in Yud Aleph regarding treating a cancer with palliative care. Yud Beis is the Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg. They both make the same point. I'm going to use Yud Beis because it's shorter. He says, Hadas note that logically, he says, my mind is inclined to say shegam hayisurin mitzar mes haadam kshem kashim lo aleinu gam hema mekarvim echshu es misa. So he says logically, suffering which causes a person pain when it's really bad, God forbid, also hastens the person's death. Based on a Gemara in Ksuvos, he says that even moaning, when a person is moved to moan, even that breaks half of a person's body. So he says, alleviate the patient's pain, because that's actually going to help save his life. And that will help address some cases, but it doesn't help address all cases. Because what about where pain is not what's being alleviated? Like in the case of potentially administering a treatment that will render the man impotent, where we're not dealing with a pain situation. Or what about surgeries like the amputation that actually increase pain? His answer doesn't suffice. It's a good answer for a specific area. So I want to offer a third approach, and I think this is a very strong approach. It's based in writings of Rav Bleich, although he doesn't say it explicitly. And that is the idea of a rapo yirape. And this is where medicine becomes different from every other human activity. If you take a look at source Yud Gimel, it's a source that I think most physicians are familiar with. Bei Rabbi Yishmael Omer, they said in the yeshiva of Rabbi Yishmael, v'rapo yirape, the Torah says that if I harm somebody, I am obligated to heal him. Right? So he says, mikan shenitan reshus l'rofe l'rapos. Based on this, physicians are given permission to heal. Good? Why do I need permission to heal a patient? Ki ani Hashem Ofecha. God is the healer, and therefore I am not entitled to heal? You know, the Gemara also says that Hashem buries the dead, because he buried Moshe. Do we wait for Hashem to do that?
It might cause
chavala. It might cause wounding. So therefore, my permission is to wound in the course of healing. So take a look at source Yud Dalet, where we're going to take what Laser is suggesting and go even further with it. It's a very interesting series of sources. Amar Rava, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, v'Amilam Rav Chisda Rabbi Yochanan, debate as to who said it, but either way, they're quoting Rabbi Yochanan. Safek chai, safek meis, ein misrapin mehen. The brackets are my added words. Me'ovde kochavim shema yargu l'chola. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah is talking about a concern that if you went to someone who wasn't Jewish and asked him to heal you of something, he might take advantage of the opportunity to actually endanger you. This is talking about in the Roman era when you couldn't necessarily trust the person you went to if he was holding a razor blade. So the Gemara says you can't go to them for medical treatment. Even if you're in a situation where, God forbid, your life is in danger already. Can't do it because they might kill the patient. Vadai meis, whereas if the patient knows that he's in a life and death situation anyway, he's dying anyway, misrapin mehen, so let him go to the doctor. Who cares if the doctor might kill him? He's dying anyway. To which the Gemara says, really? Meis haika chaye shah, but he has time left. Right? Maybe in his current condition, he has a week of life left. And and if the doctor kills him, he's going to lose that week. He's losing temporary life. To which the Gemara says, L'chaye shah lo chay shinan. We're not worried about losing temporary life. From which we derive that a patient is permitted to endanger short-term life in the pursuit of long-term survival. That's one of the things that we permit a physician to do, is to treat a patient knowing that the treatment may kill him short-term, because if it doesn't, it'll actually extend his life longer. Based on that, the Ramban writes in Taras HaAdam, he deals with this, he deals with the case of the son bloodletting for the father, and he says, I'm going to jump the actual source itself, it's a great source, but we're just going to be short on time otherwise. The Ramban writes that it's known that medicine is dangerous. It's known that medicine causes pain. And the point of rapo yirape, as Laser suggested, is to permit medical treatment, even where it's dangerous, even where it's going to cause pain. Rav Kook took this also in Source Ted Zion. He says, "Upashtam shal divrei chazal." The simple explanation of the words of the Chachamim is, "V'rapo yirape mikan shenitna tara shenasna tara rishus l'rofei l'rapos morekein sheikar harafua mitzad chachmasa mesupek es hi." He says, "Medicine itself is frankly doubtful." Shemaya davar barur eich yale al adas shloyem chuyev l'rapos. He says, "If it was obvious that this is the way to heal the patient, then you know what we would do." Of course we would heal him. I wouldn't need a heter from a pasuk. He says, isn't there a principle of don't stand by your brother's blood? No matter what it is that's happening to him. Lest you argue that I'm not allowed to heal because God was the one who made this person sick. He says, you know, if I see someone attacked by lions, I'm obligated to try to save his life. Even though the lions also were sent by God. Rav Kook says, of course. We don't say, well, God put him in that situation and therefore you're not entitled to intervene. God forbid. He says the point of rapo yirape is that you don't always know what the right treatment is, and you do it anyway. That's mikan shenitna rishus l'rofe l'rapos. That's the physician's permission that the Torah is giving. The Titz Eliezer, or Eliezer Waldenberg, is particularly articulate on this point. You see it in Source Yud Zayin. He says, you know, every medicine has side effects. He says aspirin can cause internal bleeding. That'll be very, very serious. And yet, we give aspirin. He says on every single box of medication, there are instructions to the physician of how to use this medication because there are potentially harmful side effects. He says, what doctor won't prescribe antibiotics, even though there are potential complications involved? He says surgery involves all sorts of danger, whether from the surgery itself or from the anesthesia. If we were instructed, I'm just doing a rough translation as I'm going through it. He says, if we were instructed to act only when we had certain success, there would be no such thing as the practice of medicine. And his last line I like is the play on words in Hebrew. Hashikul harifu'i hu ha'izun bein hasikui l'sikun. He says, the medical calculation, the medical decision, is the balance between opportunity and threat. But in Hebrew, it's sikui and sikun, which has a lot better ring to it. But he says, realistically, that's what the doctor does. This is very important. Because what it's fundamentally saying is that the medical act which the Torah sanctions is dangerous and is painful and is not a given. And it's okay for the physician to administer a treatment knowing all of those things. Which is why Abaye says what he says to Rav Acha in Source Yud Ches. Rav Acha says, Hanichnas lahakiz dam, someone who's going in for bloodletting, Omer, he should say the following tefillah. He says, God, please may this involvement, may the bloodletting be a healing thing for me. Utrap eini, and you should heal me. Kikel rofe neman ata, you, God, are a faithful physician. Rufuas ba'emes, your healing is true. Lefisha ein darkon shal b'nei adam l'rapos ela shenagu. Because people don't normally heal, it's just we engage in these practices. That's his apology for seeking medical treatment. And Amar Abaye, Abaye says, Lo lema inish hachi, do not dare say that. Why? Detanet vera bishmal. Because it's not true. Verapo yirape, Hashem gave us permission to do this. You don't need to apologize for getting treatment. This is what we're supposed to be doing, says Abaye. So, what emerges from this is that medical acts which risk health and even cause harm are acceptable because it's the nature of medicine. This is not mitzvah ba'avera. Harming the patient while healing him is not the same thing as stealing someone's lulav. Aside from the fact that when I steal a lulav, I'm harming somebody else for the sake of my mitzvah, which is another reason why it's not analogous. But it's also not analogous because the medical act, by definition, that which is the mitzvah, is potentially a harmful act, and it's still called the mitzvah. There are two exceptions to this rule. One exception is a life and death case. Pikuach nefesh is different. And so, Rosh Shlomo Zalman Orbach in Source Yates, going back to the case of palliative care in an end-of-life situation, he wrote this at a time when they had not yet found that you could administer the morphine without depressing the patient's breathing to the point of killing him. So in his reality, he's dealing with where, potentially, each dose of morphine could kill the patient. And this is what he wrote. Nisinas trufos harga, etc. Ho'el v'yisurim kashim ma'od la'adam. In his specific cases where the patient hasn't requested it. The patient is not conscious. So he says, ho'el v'yisurim kashim ma'od la'adam v'yisur l'sovlam. Where he says, because pain is great for a person and you can't bear it, and he quotes the Gemara on Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah and their torture by the Babylonians, Mistabish et Srichim Larachim al Hachola, it's logical to say that we must have mercy on the patient, Ulahakel Alav Asivlo, and ease his suffering, Ulahashkit Bima'adas Hakeivim, and to do what we can to reduce his pain. Certainly when this strong pain actually weakens and harms the person more than the medicine does, which is the note about pain being damaging to a person. Kamuvan, but he says, of course, your intent can only be to ease the pain. The fact that it will end his life, well, that's something, it's an unintended result. Granted, it's guaranteed, it's not what I want to have happen. And he says in parentheses, though, and this is key, he says, I'm only mentioning psikresha to use a colloquial term, but it's not technically psikresha guaranteed result. You know why? Because guaranteed results in psikresha, darshan, and miskavin aren't relevant to medicine. That's why it's only a melitza. It's not relevant, really. All those principles of, is this guaranteed, is this not guaranteed, and all that, don't relate to the medical act. Because the medical act, it's understood that even if there is a guaranteed result, nonetheless, it's still medical. I care about not causing the patient's death, though, in Source Chaf. He says, V'chol zeh, kishein kol zrika uzrika b'fnei atzma mekatzeres chaye hachola be'echreyach, ela mibein rabos miskatzrim chayav. He's only willing to permit the morphine if each individual dose will not shorten the life of the patient in any definite way. It's just that the accumulation does. So writes Shlomo Zalman. Rav J. David Bleich, in an article in Tradition in 2002, took him to task on that last point about each individual dose. It's an interesting discussion, worth seeing. If anyone wants, I can email you what Rav Bleich wrote. But the point for our purposes is this. If you're dealing with a life and death situation, that's a different story. The license to the physician to practice medicine does not license him to engage in an action which is going to kill the patient. That's a limit. The second limit is where the action is going to cause some other prohibition. because mikancha nitna rishus larope larapos permits me to heal a patient despite causing him pain or some negative side effect, it doesn't permit me to violate other prohibitions in the Torah. That's why I brought the Paxil case. Even if the Paxil case per se is not actually serious, I'm not saying that it is. Even if it's not, the point is, I will not be permitted to treat a patient in a way that's going to cause him to inevitably violate a prohibition. I can treat him in a way that will cause inevitable harm, as long as it's less than the benefit, but I can't treat him in a way that's going to cause inevitable violation of a prohibition. Life-saving cases being a thing unto themselves. Yes? Right.
So you've got 90% chance that the Paxil did not cause the impotence, but in fact may improve his life, and by improving the depression, then he may engage
in. Right. So that's an excellent question. The answer seems to be, and this requires really a longer shear of its own, but the answer seems to be that when we're talking about Isurim, first of all, a percentage that's less than 10%. Is what we call miut she'eino matzui. It's an unusual minority and not one that we generally have to worry about. But then also we get into the issue of calculating cost and benefit. So if I'm dealing with a patient who is severely depressed, we actually consider that almost a case of pikuach nefesh, if not actual pikuach nefesh. And therefore I'll be able to justify certainly giving a treatment. And again, I stress, the Paxil case may not be serious at all. So I don't want to confuse things by listing it that way, even though I did. But in general, if the harm of not treating is sufficiently great, think about what we do for Shabbos, for example. Right? If a patient has a fever, if it's a child, we have all sorts of ways of leniencies. We will say, you can violate Shabbos for this purpose, for this purpose, for this purpose. It depends on the case. But you're right, that then we have to balance. Where it's not inevitable, we have to start balancing. So, to come back to our initial issue of double effect, and I think this will help highlight the differences. In principle, based on Verapo Yerapei, we say the following. In a case of intended destruction, where I actually intend to destroy, I'm amputating, for example, we say it's part of the medical act, it's permitted, like that Rama on amputating the father's limb. Even though it's intended, I'm allowed to do it. If it's inevitable, and if it's inevitable destruction, though, and it's unintended, but it's beyond the medical act, like the Cirrus case, then we prohibit it. And if it's pikuach nefesh, if there's an issue of pikuach nefesh, then all the rules go out the window. So let me apply it to the cases and see if that helps to clarify. If you take a look on your first sheet, the table at the bottom, talking about the vaccine with a strong reaction, both double effect and virapo yirape will permit the vaccine. Double effect will permit it because it'll say the strong reaction to the vaccine is an unintended side effect. I'm not causing a fever in order to vaccinate the patient. So double effect is fine with the vaccine. We're fine with the vaccine also, because virapo yirape. It's a wounding that takes place within the treatment. Everyone clear on that? Good? Okay. Second, amputating the gangrenous limb. It's clear that we will permit it, because it's necessary for the procedure. But on the other hand, the double effect principle really will not. Because I am amputating the limb in order to treat. It's where the harm is actually the means to the end. So what did they do? I mean, doctors who follow double effect do amputate limbs. So they do one of several things. One approach I've seen in the literature is that they argue that amputation is a morally neutral act. In other words, amputation is not actually harmful. By definition, it could be good, it could be bad. It's sort of a Gemara answer. We're going to redefine amputation. Amputation is not called wounding. That's one approach. The second approach that they offer is, if I'm amputating a gangrenous limb, the limb is no longer functional, it's no longer a part of the body. And therefore, you can amputate it, because it's not called amputation. You're cutting away something that isn't really a part of the body at all. Another approach they say is, well, double effect has its limits. There are points where you can't employ the principle anymore. It's beyond the scope. Because they recognize in all the literature, I can give you a lot of articles on this. Too many, probably. But they recognize that double effect, in fact, will rule that amputating a limb is prohibited. Rapo Yurape has no problem with that. So that's an area in which we differ. Palliative end-of-life care, assuming that it actually would depress the patient's breathing to the point of the patient dying, with the caveat, though, as we said before, it doesn't necessarily do that. So according to double effect, you're okay, as long as your goal is not to kill. Whereas under Rapo Yurape, you're only okay if, number one, your goal is not to kill, and number two, each individual dose that you administer will not kill the patient. Because if it's inevitable, then we won't allow it. Got it? What about keeping the patient from gasping, the anti-gasping paralytics? So double effect will approve, assuming the benefit is sufficient to warrant it. I say assuming that the benefit is sufficient to warrant it, because in the literature they point out that really it may not be that you may not be doing this for the patient's comfort. It may be more about the family's comfort that's there in the room, which is a whole other can of worms. But that's assuming there's sufficient benefit, they'll say sure, because they'll argue that you're not ultimately trying to suffocate the patient. I'm sorry, no. Double effect in the case... No, I'm right. Okay, that's fine. Or will it? You know what? I backtrack on what I wrote there. Right, they'll prohibit it. Double effect will have to... That's a mistake. On the chart where it says approves if sufficient benefit, I'll have to correct that before I upload it. They will have to prohibit the paralytic agent. The reason they'll have to prohibit it is because it's going to be the means to the end. In other words, stopping the patient from breathing is the means to the end. Whereas for us, we will say it's prohibited if death is inevitable. So in fact, we're really saying the same thing. We'll agree on that. In the case of Cirrus, in the case of administering the medication that will render the patient impotent, so double effect will permit it because it's not intended. Right? That's not the mechanism by which the medicine acts. Whereas Rapo Yurape will actually prohibit it. Because they'll say, well, Rapo Yurape doesn't permit prohibitions. It only permits paining the patient. And finally, the ectopic pregnancy is fascinating. Anyone know what the church actually recommends for treating an ectopic pregnancy? They have a problem. The problem is that terminating the pregnancy, aborting the fetus, requires that you perform the harm in order to cause the benefit. So they won't let you use the methotrexate. What they do instead is they say you have to cut off the site, do surgery to cut off the site where the embryo is lodged. Because that way, your main goal is to cut off that spot to help the mother, not to abort the fetus. The fetal abortion ends up happening along the way. It's an indirect result. That's what they do. Whereas for us, recognizing that we don't consider the fetus an independent life, it's considered to be a part of the mother, we will actually permit the abortion via the medication because the harm is an act of permitted chavala. You are wounding the mother in the sense that you are aborting the fetus, but that's part of treating the mother medically. So that's another case of difference. To me, this is very important. Sorry?
So, up to the Paxil case, I'm pretty much following it. That's okay, so I have trouble with.
Yeah.
And I'm sure many people here would have a lot of difficulty.
Yeah.
In the case of if the person has benign prostatic hypertrophy and an office first surgical approach has been discussed and that's not life threatening, then there is a risk of cirrhosis and that has been permitted as well. So
what's the percentage risk?
I'll leave it to the surgeons here. I won't answer that.
Does anybody know? What's the percentage risk in the case laser is describing?
I'm going to go on. I think it's 100% because the nature of the procedure is by definition you're cutting off the vas.
So it's not.
Not currently. I'm talking about prior to when at the time when Rabosha was writing you didn't have the current method. It was 100%. I'll leave it to surgeons, but that's my understanding of it.
Mm-hmm.
And in other words.
And it was a case where it was benign, where there was no threat that this was going to metastasize.
No, but I mean, even if the person has benign prostatic hypertrophy, and the person has it, they can't live. I mean, there's a sentiment. So you're differentiating between
failure. It's a good article that covered a lot.
Yeah.
That the Lavisher never wrote.
Yeah.
It was the 80th, Russ birthday.
Okay.
And it's in Covered Up. You don't have,
I have Covered Up, yeah. All right, I'll have to take a look. So my answer to you is I'm going to look into it and get back to the group. Because I, according to the principles that we're setting out, which I think are fairly well grounded, if in fact you're dealing with a case in which the patient can live with it, then I don't understand why the serous would be permitted. But I don't know enough about, number one, the condition that's being described, and number two, the risk involved in order to actually speak about it.
Not prescribed capsules is a very common, it's probably a massive emulsion for young for every physician here.
Right.
Primary care.
Right. Again, the Paxil case, I want to stress, is not... I don't intend the Paxil case as a Lamisa case. Number one, because what I was sort of hinting at in the beginning is that serous via the Paxil mechanism is likely not serous. Because weakening the patient's desire is not the same thing as weakening the patient's physical ability. Well, that's the Kosh Shalikaran is the classic case of the Gemara.
So let's say in the old days when you had cimetidine, I mean a drug that you did use to treat, and there the effect was definitely lower the sperm count.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a definite, as opposed
interesting.
To, so it was definite. That was the mechanism.
Was it lifelong once he took a dose, or was it only for the duration of the medication?
The duration of the treatment.
Mm-hmm. And it was a treatment for? Interesting.
No, early on it was only used for GRPs back in 77.
So I can look into it. Again, that's not a case that I'm familiar with. But the core principle that medicine for the sake of treating an ailment that's not life-threatening does not automatically override other isurim, other prohibitions, is a sound principle. The only question is in terms of the specifics of how we're going to apply it, just like for Shabbos.
Or
yeah.
Is the case with an... case where it could be life-threatening prostate cancer, but radical prostatectomy is only one option. There are other options for treatment. So if you're as a patient considering different options, is that a halachic consideration?
It's definitely a halachic consideration. The same way that when we said that the child is able to operate on the parent, he's not if there's somebody else who can operate on the parent. If we have the ability to avoid the isser, then we avoid the isser. So the question then becomes, well, what about if there's someone else who could do the surgery, but he's not as good as the kid is? You know, the kid is a much better surgeon. So now who do you go to?
What if the parent wants the child to do it, doesn't want someone else?
Right, so apparently the parent is not necessarily able to be mochel on this. Mochel in the kavod is different from mochel in their blood. It's a good question, but I think that's the approach. But the question of not all physicians being equal is an important one, because the Gemara recognizes that, and it comes up in halacha in a variety of ways in terms of whether a physician can refuse to treat, and what about if they come to you but there's someone else you could refer them to, and the like. It comes up. We generally say that each physician is obligated to consider. Well, let me not go there. That's not necessarily true. I want to do research on the specific cases that are being mentioned before I speak about them. I don't want to overstate. But the core principle here is that double effect, the idea that a physician is obligated to avoid all pain in giving the treatment and avoid causing harm in giving treatment unless it's unintentional and unless the benefit exceeds the cost, is not a halachic calculus. That's not the way we look at it. We understand that the treatment that's given may well cause pain, may well, in fact, not be the right treatment. It may even be dangerous. And that's what we're given license to do in Virapo Yirape, so long as we're not endangering life, so long as we're not violating other prohibitions, again, subject to the severity of the prohibition involved and the greatness of the need involved, and and of course, subject to the judgment of the physician that this is, in fact, the course to take. Thank you very much.